Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're on the trot to get this week rolling. Then we'll hear how to run away from some of the scams that are pursuing you right now. At 10, we're going to double back and hear more about the rare lady beetles recently found in the state. And we'll finish off the morning talking politics just 8 days before Vermont's primary election. But let's get our bodies in motion to open the show, and that's something our first guests love to talk about. John Kerrigan is the cross-country coach at Harwood Union High School for 44 years. Do I have that right? He joins us now to talk about several running topics. John, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Yeah, thanks. That's right. 44 years.
44 years. Get out of here.
Great morning to be a skyrunner. Plenty of blue sky.
Yeah, it sure is. And we have Ryan Kerrigan. He is the USA Skyrunning coach. Ryan, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you so much for having us this morning, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask John and Ryan about the Harwood runs going on or to talk about skyrunning, you can call us at 802-244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. Or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Ryan, what in the world is skyrunning?
Yeah, it's a good question. It seems pretty open to interpretation at times, but basically, if you look at a given landscape, think what's the hardest thing that you can do on 2 feet, and that's pretty much skyrunning.
Well, there's two parts to it. There's vertical, and then a full on run. So, explain the kind of two things you do in a competition.
Yeah, for the youth champs, there's two events, as you say. There's the vertical kilometer, which is 1,000 meters of vertical gain in less than 5K. The races that we were just at in Aransol was 1,000 meters of gain in 3.5K. So it was very, very steep race. And then there's a sky race, there's a recovery day one day, and then a sky race the following day. And that's anywhere from 10 to 20 kilometers and achieving 1,000 to 1,500 meters of vertical gain. So a little bit higher than our biggest mountains here in Vermont from base to summit. But just as our mountains are just as technical.
And, Ryan, not everyone is as proficient in geography as you. Aransol is in Andorra, correct, in Europe?
Yep, little tiny country smushed between Spain and France.
That's right. So think like Liechtenstein, Luxembourg, Andorra, San Remo, some of those wee little countries that Europe has. John, how did you first learn about skyrunning?
Well, through Ryan. He came home, came home one night and said, yeah, was running a camp for kids and said, I'm looking for something for the kids to do during the summer. And, we found this race, the World Youth Championships in Andorra, and, he contacted the meet director, and we went over with 8 Vermonters, and the kids loved it. They loved us over there and invited us back and wanted to bring kids from all over the country, which we've been doing.
When was that? When was the first time?
Well, may I interject?
Sure, please.
Beyond that, we were looking for, as the Harwood cross country team has come along and gotten just stronger and stronger throughout the years, thanks to, my dad's 40 plus years of coaching. We were looking for opportunities outside of Vermont for those cross-country runners, and we were noticing that a lot of the national higher-profile cross-country races were leading us to hot, flat places. And local kids in Vermont, especially Harwood High School at the base of Campbell's Hump, they love to run the hills, and they're good at it. So we're looking for a youth event that highlighted that stronger hill runner. Mm. And I saw that skyrunning was putting on a youth World Championship, and I thought, well, this will be hilly.
And when we talk about skyrunning, John, talk about how high those mountains that the kids, that the competitors run in have to be a minimum of.
Well, they have to be a minimum of 2,000 meters for a World Championship. Which we don't have, as Ryan said, we don't have any mountains in Vermont that are that height.
And often, just to, John, you know, let me just cut you off, just so because we talk in feet here, and our highest are, you know, around 4,000 feet. 2,000 meters is like 6,500 feet, correct?
Yeah, approximately. Yeah. The race in Andorra this past week was about 10,000 feet.
Wow.
So it some of the kids will start feeling the altitude. I know I did when I hiked up.
But, my.
So we have kids that, you know, we had a girl from Lake Tahoe area who lived at that elevation, and she did quite well. So we're finding pockets of kids around the country that are familiar with that elevation, Colorado, Alaska, and places like that. And they don't have a problem adapting to the altitude. But for Vermont kids, it's an eye-opener. You know, you're dealing with the steepness of the terrain and also the altitude. But they come through like Vermonters do. They're real troopers.
Ryan, tell us about the team you took over, the U.S. team that you took over to Andorra.
We had five athletes this year, a couple from Alaska, one from Minnesota, who's also part-time in, well, originally Spanish, but living in Minnesota for school and with his father there, and two other athletes from Burke, who are also living part-time in France near the Chamonix area.
Mm. And, John, the weather over there, how was it for the
right
runs?
Here, record-setting temperatures.
Yeah.
The European continent has never seen temperature, rarely seen temperatures this high, even in the, you know, in the summer. And even at altitude, it was tough. The kids from Alaska, we were real worried about them. You know, it never gets above 70 degrees in most parts of Alaska, and it was close to 100 during some of the races.
And I watched some of the videos of the competition, and Ryan, just doing that vertical kilometer, you know, these kids are kind of running doubled over. It is, you know, it's not an easy climb before you get to the, you know, to the ridges. Explain how hard that is to just get up the mountain.
Yeah, it's actually, there was a conversation at these last champs regarding the difficulty of 1,000 meters of vertical in less than 5K, especially for the younger kids, the U18s.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a big undertaking. We've had some requests from some other athletes in the Midwest who are, you know, mid packers on their high school cross country or track team, and they've seen some sky running videos and media and so on and think, oh wow, that really looks fun. And just, you know, to give them some back, I said, do you know what a VK is? Do you know what a vertical kilometer is? And sometimes the answer is no. So I'm just wary of who we're inviting on the trip and making sure they're fully cognizant of just how difficult of a race it is.
It's funny, when I watch those videos, the word fun never came into my mind, not for 1 second. I did not see that.
Well, you know, when you get to the top, there's a lot of fun. I mean, this year, the Brazilians were up there and just, you know, it was a party. And they're cheering everybody on. I mean, there could be competitors that are battling each other midway through the VK, and at the top, they're hugging and singing and clapping for everybody else. So it's a great atmosphere.
So once you get to the top, once you do the VK and you start to run, you know, on these ridges, at altitude, how far do they run, Ryan, and what kind of course is it?
Well, like I said, the course will try to achieve some kind of a summit. And, you know, whereas most American trail running or ultra running events are, we seem to be focused on the distance. It's either 25K or 50K or 50 mile or 100 mile, and 100 mile isn't cool anymore. If you do 200 miles, it'd be cool. Whereas for sky running, the event is really more focused on the vertical. So with the sky race, they do hope to have some portion of the race on an exposed ridgeline. It could be shorter or it could be longer, but some portion where the athletes are running above the clouds.
And we should mention, these aren't really groomed runs that you're on. The terrain is difficult, and then John, the descent isn't much easier, is it?
Oh no, the descent is worse, I think, than the vertical, because you're footing, you're on loose rock and scree, and you know, you move your foot up or down an inch in the wrong direction, and you could take a spill. The finish line of after the Sky Race is quite colorful. You know, a lot of blood, a lot of scrapes, a lot of people falling down. But that's the technical aspect of the sport. Like anything else, you have to learn how to do it, and you get better with practice. But as Ryan said, you're above tree line, and that's how I think skyrunning got its name, because when you look from a distance, you see these runners like little ants on the ridge, and it looks like they've been literally dropped from the sky. It's amazing to watch.
If only. Ryan, how did your runners or skyrunners do in Andorra?
I'm really happy with their performance. I think they did quite well. I think some of our strongest athletes were the ones from Alaska. And as an athlete traveling to Europe for the first time, I think you learn a lot about your body and how it responds to that amount of travel. I mean, 9 time zones, the heat, the altitude. Everyone ran well. No one, I think, ran quite to their potential. But I think it's a great experience for them. It will help outline how to perform at a higher level in Europe in the future.
And tell us about Josh's odyssey.
Oh, Josh Taylor, poor kid. He did all the right things. He got over to Europe a little bit earlier to give himself some more time to acclimate. And he's from Alaska. That's right. Yes. The one thing he did wrong was decided to check his bag, which anything that you absolutely need on your trip overseas, you want it right next to you all the time. But he chose to put it in cargo, and that was the last he saw of it. Beyond that, I think a lot of athletes would have whined, would have made excuses, would have thought, well, it's just not going to be my week, and maybe taking it out on other competitors or coaches or so on. And Josh was just not that person whatsoever.
Hey, let me add, Josh has a gluten allergy.
Right.
As what he needed to treat his gluten was in his luggage.
Yeah.
So it even made it more difficult. And then, of course, he flew in Lufthansa, and on the way back, he went to the airport and found out Lufthansa was on strike. So he kind of roamed around Barcelona for a few days.
He'll come back to Europe again someday.
Has he finally made it back to Alaska?
He did. I got a text from him just yesterday, and he is back home. And his mother, I think, is very, very happy.
Oh, thank goodness. Great stories from the World Championships, the Youth World Championships of skyrunning in Andorra. Both John and Ryan were there. Now, John, let's talk about more local and less altitude. What goes on at these cross-country summer fun run and walks at Harwood?
Yeah, we've been hosting these for a few years, and it's a way to get younger kids and, you know, older people and people who just want to, you know, get out in the outdoors and get some recreation. We've had kids as little as, you know, 2-3 years old, and people as, you know, my age, I'm going to be 70 and older, out there running. And we've had people locally and people who are visiting the area come and run. The run is basically divided into we have a kids run at 6:30. And we designed the course according to the ability of the kids. You know, real little kids will run maybe 100 meters, older kids maybe a little less than a mile. And then we have the three-mile loop, which is broken into two parts. Is you can run the first 1.5 mile, and you decide, hey, you know, I don't think I can do the whole 3 mile. You can quit, and we'll get your time. If you run the 1.5 mile and say, hey, I'm feeling pretty good, I want to do the 3 mile, you know, we'll time you on that. So. And it's not really a race. It's a run with other people. The members of the Harwood cross country team are out there encouraging everybody and running side by side with people and with each other. And it's just a fun time. The course is pretty easy. You know, it's hilly over here in South Duxbury, but I've made it as flat as possible. to encourage people to run.
And then what time do people show up to be part of it?
We have registration at 6, and we start the kids' fun run at 6:30. We're usually out of there by, you know, depending on how fast people run, by, you know, 7 o'clock or 7:30, the latest. But it's just a fun time. Some people hang out and talk and chat, and actually some of them continue to run after that, do a little cool down together. And tonight we have some members of the Team Berkey coming, Caitlin Compton Gregg, who was a 1998 Harvard alum, who was also a 2010 Vancouver Olympian in Nordic skiing.
Wow.
She is bringing over some of her elite athletes. Some of these are people are at least one has been an Olympian in this past Olympics, and some of these people may make the Olympic team next time around. They're coming to Vermont. She wanted to show them where she grew up and some of the trails and the experiences and the hills. And she said the kids have been blown away by the beauty of Vermont and the challenges of the terrain.
Yeah. Hey, Ryan, rounding to the nearest 100, how many times would you say you've run that loop, that 3-mile loop there?
Wow. Yeah. It's just a blur. I think there was a point I could probably do it with my eyes closed, but I think my dad's done it more times than his pickup truck.
Well, I walk it almost every day, so or at least parts of it almost
wow.
every day. So, yeah, it's a nice loop. It's shaded, so in a hot day like today, it's really much cooler in the woods, and there's water all around, and a lot of the kids will, you know, jump in the brook or find another swimming hole to go to after they run, which is it's a fun time.
That's lovely. Hey, let's take a call from Newberry. We've got Fred on the line. Morning, Fred.
Morning. Hey, the ultimate race is the Pacific Crest Trail race. You ever hear of that one?
Oh, I'm sure these guys know it. Yep.
Sure.
Have you run it, Fred?
No, I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail.
Yep.
Back in, I think it was 1964. And it's very interesting. It's a national scenic trail. And what happened was it was a collection of old trails like the John Muir Trail. They had an equestrian trail down south, and then you had to go on the dirt roads. It was really a very interesting navigation feat. And while I was out there doing it, they were rebuilding the trail, and they were spending a considerable amount of money on it. I was up in the mountains, and there was an outfit up there, and they were building it. And back in 1964, this guy had made a bid for, I think it was a mile in he put his bid in for about $80,000 per mile, or I mean, it might have been as high as 100.
All right, Fred, thanks for that. Ryan, I'm sure you've run some pretty rigorous races. How does sky running compare to other runs that you've done in your life?
Well, like I said, you know, particularly in North America, there's a big fixation on the distance, whereas sky running, the distance is kind of that's extra. But what's the most vertical that we can gain? And most of the competitive trail races or ultra races that I've done in the area or within the U.S. are, you know, by and large, yeah, you can run it, but you could also ride your bike. You could ride your horse. A lot of them, you could drive your car.
Right.
Whereas sky running, the only way you're getting there is on foot or a helicopter, which I don't have a helicopter.
Right. Now, John, getting back to Harwood, and this is not sky running, so folks, don't be afraid to show up tonight at 6 o'clock, get registered, and get in the run or walk. But, John, what is the goal of these events? Why do you have them every summer?
I think just to encourage families, you know, that running is a great sport. And it's also, you know, you don't have to be a full-time runner. It's a great conditioner cardiovascularly. And it also gets you in shape for other activities. You know, a lot of people play soccer or, you know, do other sports in the fall or ski in the winter. And it's just a way of getting in the outdoors with like-minded people and have a good time.
I'll admit that even though I'm not a runner, I peaked at 10K. You can do it. Even somebody like me can get out there, you know, work at it, get up to 5K, 5-miler. I made it to a 10K. I did pass out at the finish line once and had many last place finishes in 5Ks and 10Ks, but that's a different kind of running career than others have had. John, what is the cost? And tell us about the summer pass.
Okay, yeah, we have it's $5 per runner. Kids under five are free in the kids race. And we do have a family pass for $50 for the season. You can enter as many races as you want with as many members of your family as you'd like. And all the money goes to support the Harwood Cross Country Team. It's a fundraiser for our trip to Belfast, Maine, where we compete at the Maine Festival of Champions. And, you know, it costs us quite a bit of money to get, 50, 60 kids over to Maine for a weekend, and this helps defer the cost.
Outstanding. It's already started, so tonight you'll be doing it. How long does it go for then, John?
We'll go until probably the last weekend in last Monday in August, just before school starts.
All right.
At least for the kids, yeah.
And, Ryan, I understand this course has the stamp of approval of L.E. Perrier St. Pierre.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's really great throughout the years here. Not only Ellie, but other runners who have come through the Northern Vermont high school cross country scene to go on to run very strong levels collegiately or nationally, professionally. And to hear them say, come back years later and say the Harwood cross country course was their favorite course.
Mm, gotta love it.
Yeah.
John Carrigan has been the cross-country coach at Harwood Union High School for 44 years. Ryan Carrigan is the USA Skyrunning coach. And to learn more about Harwood's summer fun runs and walks, which get started at 6:30 each Monday evening, you can email John at hurunning13@gmail.com. And for info on Skyrunning, you can go to skyrunningus.com. John, Ryan, always a pleasure having you on the show. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thanks so much, Rick.
Take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we'll return to find out who's trying to scam you and how. And tonight, the Sox head to Texas. They take on the AL West leading Astros. Our coverage begins at 7:10. First pitch is 8:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and it's time to check in with the person who keeps us from getting complacent about fending off the ubiquitous scammers who are trying everything in their powers to get your cash or personal information. Joining me now is Elliot Greenblatt, the volunteer coordinator of the AARP Vermont Fraud Watch Network. He authors a biweekly fraud education column appearing in newspapers throughout New England. Elliot, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, good morning, Rick. It's, again, a pleasure to be talking to you again. And hopefully this message will ring to home for everybody, literally.
All right. Let's shoot for a fraud-free week, Elliot. First of all, let's talk about telephone scams. Why are these things... why do they keep happening? Why are they effective that scammers love them?
Well, you know, there are a couple reasons. They come in two flavors. One is the robocall, that automated phone call with a pleasant voice that asks you some questions. And that's a virtually free service to scammers because they use a computer to make a call. And people kind of get wrapped into it because the voice is kind of familiar and very comfortable. The other type of call is the live call, where you have a person who actually is on the phone with you. And typically when that phone rings and you pick it up, you'll hear a click, which is when the computer that's making the call connects you with the caller himself. This, again, is computer-assisted. The people who are making the calls are kind of low fruit on the tree. They're very low-paid callers and almost exclusively calling from overseas call centers. So, you know, those are the two varieties. Why are they effective? Well, first, you know, we know they're effective because 2 years ago, according to the Federal Trade Commission, $86 million in losses to consumers based on robocalls. That's what was reported. We have no idea what wasn't reported to the Federal Trade Commission. But they're effective because phones are a pretty easy means of contact. Most people are walking around with a phone. You think back 30 years ago, if you wanted to use a phone, you have to go into a building and use a payphone. Today, everybody's walking around with their phone, so the contact is right there. We're, as a public, kind of hardwired to pick up the phone. A lot of people simply, you hear the phone ring, you answer it. And that's part of your routine. It was beaten into you by your parents, most likely. And so, you know, it's just a natural act. We're also kind of hardwired to be polite and respectful. Again, we can blame our parents for that if we wanted to call that something to blame them for.
Right.
But, you know, you answer the phone, you don't say, what do you want? You say, hello. And you try and be friendly when you answer the phone. And, again, that's something that we're hardwired to do. And it makes us more effective as targets. And the scammers are really good at playing on our emotions and also in social engineering, in kind of, you know, getting us to answer what they want us to answer as opposed to something else. Somebody asks you a question, you'll generally respond to it directly. You won't try and play games with it. And that's what they're counting on.
Hey, we've got a call from Kathleen over in New York State. Let's talk to her. Hi, Kathleen. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you. I've called once before about blueberries, actually.
I know.
But my question is, I was telling you the last time I called that I do live out on a 400-acre farm, and I literally don't go anywhere. I mean, when I say I don't, I really don't, except for groceries about twice a month. My bank called me Friday and said that my bank card was used in London, England, in the UK, and there were several attempts to accept money from my bank over the last month. And it's bizarre to me because I don't use my card and I don't use it. I meant maybe I bought somebody a gift online once. And so my question is, what, I mean, could it have been when I bought a gift online, or maybe was I at a gas station and I don't recall it? How do these card numbers of banks, get into the hands of these people?
Great question, Kathleen. Elliot, this is a big one, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a big one because it's happening more and more frequently. Basically, the number gets into a criminal's hands through a number of different processes, but it could be at a location where you use a card. For instance, there might be a skimmer, a device on the device that you're trying to use. That will copy the information off your card. Another way that it happens, and sadly more frequently, is we end up giving that number to somebody that we shouldn't be giving it to. It may be on a purchase online from a fraudulent supplier. It could be an email that you get saying there's a problem with your account. We need to have you verify your account information. Once it gets in the hands of one scammer, you can kind of assume that it's going to be in the hands of all scammers. And there are some good steps to take to kind of at least thwart that to some degree. The first thing is check your credit card accounts regularly.
Yep.
I would say at least once a week. You can go online. It's very safe. The connection is an encrypted website, so you don't have to worry about somebody being able to get into that website to steal your information. But you check your account, see if there are any unrelated charges that are appearing, and sometimes they can be as little as $1. That's the criminal checking to see whether the number works. And if it does, then shortly afterwards you'll see a large purchase. So check your accounts. If you find that there's something you don't expect, contact the credit card company immediately and contact them with the credit card call number on the back of the card. That's your best bet. If you get a notice online or a text message or a phone call, don't trust it. It could be a scammer trying to get that information. Use a reliable number that you can verify.
Great call, Kathleen, and I hope to goodness that any attempts to use your card were denied. Let's go next to Crown Point, going back to New York State and talking to Frank. Hi, Frank. Your turn. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Thank you so much for the topic. One thing that I am very careful about when I receive a call from a number that I don't recognize is that when they ask if this is me, you know, my name, that I don't say yes. Because I think they could use that against you.
Interesting.
Now I don't know about New York State, but in Vermont, it is not considered a valid way to sign a contract by simply saying yes. So you're protected. It may also be the case in New York State. Scammers will try to use that, yes, but we don't see that happening as frequently as them actually requesting you your information directly. So I'd be less concerned about saying yes, more concerned about what follows that.
And, Elliot, what are the things that these scammers, when they call, are trying to get from us? What are they offering? What are they trying to get from us?
Well, you know, what they really want is money. Any way that they can get money from you, they're going to be happy. And if they can't get the money from you, then they'll sell your information, whatever they have, on the dark web. So money's the driving factor, you know, that line, follow the money. Well, that's how we end up knowing where the scammers are working. And for us as victims, we tend to be very submissive to authority or credibility. If somebody can pass them off as an official, they can end up getting significant gains from you. Let me just play a little audio clip, and I think some of you may have heard this.
To inform you that IRS is filing a lawsuit against you. To get more information about this case file, please call immediately on our department number 202-470-2565. I repeat, 202-470-2565. Thank you.
That's the type of message that we're seeing in robocalls. And they tend to be effective. At least this one was very effective because people hear the word IRS or Internal Revenue Service, and it sends a shudder down your spine, and there's sudden authority there. So that's one thing that drives us, submission. Secondly, we're driven by greed. If somebody offers you something that is free of charge, you're more likely to grab it than if they say, oh, it only costs you $99.99. Free is good, sort of. But when something is being offered absolutely free, you become the product, not the consumer. Your information is what they're looking for. And, you know, we're also victims of, you know, herd mentality, I guess is what I call it, or social consensus, where if everybody's doing something, it must be really good. So why don't we do it? And that gets folks in trouble. And then, like with the IRS one, if you have a sense of fear, you end up being more vulnerable. All of these are emotional. And, again, they're social engineering, trying to get you to do something that you would never do in your daily work or your daily life.
And Elliot, got a lot of questions coming in for you. First of all, right before the break, we were talking about the IRS robocall that you played. I thought it was pretty ingenious that they used a 202 callback number, which is in Washington, D.C. So I might have bit on this one. So when you call back to the quote-unquote IRS, what would they be asking you and getting from you?
Well, they want you to identify yourself. So little things like name, address, social security number. They may ask you for a credit card to make payment with. And, of course, the IRS generally doesn't accept credit cards. They may even ask you to go out and pay a particular bill owed to them using gift cards. So, again, you know, it's how they can build a money stream to them from you and do it with the threat of IRS, wage garnishment or who knows what, you know, taking your home away from you. All of the rumors about how nasty the IRS is will come through your mind and your willingness to comply.
Yeah,
increases exponentially. That's part of that social engineering issue that I mentioned.
And you've been warning against whenever they say, "Hey, pay with gift cards." You're warning against that. That should be kind of a red flare that goes up. Is that because then it's untraceable? I send gift cards off to you for $4,000, and I'm out $4,000 just like that.
Right. Totally untraceable because the cards aren't registered in anybody's name. So, it's like cash.
Yeah.
You might as well hand somebody a bag with $4,000 and say goodbye to them because it's gone. You know, I mentioned the IRS. The other one, we're seeing a lot of our calls from local police saying there's a warrant out for you.
Ooh.
And you can avoid that warrant. It might be because you ignored a jury call or something like that. All you have to do is pay by gift card. Well, first of all, I've never heard of the police calling somebody to say, by the way, we're coming over to arrest you. I've gotten that call, and I've said, oh, that's great. Do you guys like chocolate chip or peanut butter cookies? Because I'll have some ready for you. It's that sort of thing that, police aren't going to call you to warn you. Government agencies don't call or text. They send letters. So, and they certainly don't threaten people.
All right.
Those are the keys to be looking at.
Yep. Got this one from Steven. He writes, recently the ISP, internet service provider we use at home, called my girlfriend, offered one service, said it'd be free. However, we then got a bill for a different service that was offered. Are there any steps to take when a company does something like this?
There are. One you could take is to contact the Vermont Attorney General's Office Consumer Assistance Program. They work out of the University of Vermont, and they follow up on issues like this. Also the Public Service Commission, because any provider in the state of Vermont has to be working through the Vermont Public Service Commission in order to do that. So there are direct ways you can handle that. Of course, if it is a legitimate company, you can call them and tell them you're going to file a complaint. And that quite often will get things reversed or cleared up. We can't ignore the fact that some companies take cheap shots. And sadly, that to me sounds like one of the cheap shots.
Mm. All right. We had another caller who couldn't stay on the line and wondered about this. We offer our credit card numbers to all sorts of what we consider legitimate services like Venmo or Amazon, and they wondered, is it safe to keep your credit card number with those type of organizations?
Typically, it's safe. The problem is no organization is immune from being hacked. We've seen thousands of companies around the world. In the United States alone, it's been Target, Walmart, Apple Computer, Microsoft, the University of Vermont Medical Center, the Rutland Regional Medical Center. Hackers are out there, and they're trying to get that information. Generally, it is safe to give these large tech companies basic information, credit card numbers and things like that. But again, you know, do the wise thing. Monitor your credit cards.
Elliot, we've got a couple of minutes left. Let's talk about general tips, you know, that you like to let people know about so that they don't get scammed.
Well, one, the obvious one is don't give any personal or financial information out unless you can verify the identity of the person that's calling you or emailing you. We try to act out of expedience, and sometimes that gets us caught. Tech companies, if you get a call from Microsoft or from Windows or from Apple or from Geek Squad, Best Buy, they don't monitor your computer to find out if there's anything wrong. They hope that you're going to get frightened and as a result, either give them access to your computer or give them money. They don't call you. What they do is respond when a lot of people call them and tell them there's a problem, then they issue some kind of a fix. If you want to donate money to a cause, request a pledge card. Don't give a credit card number. In fact, just before the show, I received a call from an organization that called itself the Police and Troopers Beneficial Group, and the gentleman was asking me to pledge money. And I said, the two questions everybody should ask. One, are you a professional fundraiser? And sometimes they'll hedge and say, well, all the money we raise goes to this organization. And secondly, what percentage of the money that you collect goes to the charity? If they can't give you a straight answer and say something like, well, check our website, hang up.
Yep.
It's not necessarily a scam, but some of these fundraisers keep 84% of the money they collect, and only 16% go to the organization.
Elliot Greenblatt is a volunteer coordinator of the AARP Vermont Fraud Watch Network, authors a biweekly fraud education column appearing in newspapers throughout New England, and you can send questions about potential fraud to egreenblatt@aarp.org. Elliot, thanks so much for sharing this information with us again today.
Thanks again, Rick. It's been a pleasure.
We'll talk to you next month. Let's break for CBS News, then we'll return to talk about rare lady beetles. And coming up this morning at 11, it's Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Sengary. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at wdevradio.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. My next guest was with us a few weeks ago to discuss some rare lady beetles discovered in Vermont. But just as we were learning about her findings, our connection got wonky, and we missed the info we were hoping to discuss with her. So, returning to talk about lady beetles, especially some of the rarer ones in the state, is Julia Pupko, the Community Science Outreach Naturalist with the Vermont Center for Eco Studies and the Vermont Lady Beetle Atlas Coordinator. Julia, thanks for agreeing to be back on the show. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
We're happy to have you again. Listeners, to ask Julia about lady beetles, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email us, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Julia, what is the Vermont Atlas of Life?
So the Vermont Atlas of Life is a team within the Vermont Center for Eco Studies focused on documenting all of the wildlife and wild organisms in Vermont, which is quite a lot when you get into the fungi and the microbes, et cetera. But we have help from a ton of community naturalists across the state using crowdsourced platforms like iNaturalist and eBird, who are helping us document all of the wildlife they see.
And you are the Vermont Lady Beetle Atlas Coordinator. So what do you do in that role?
Yeah, so I do a couple different things as the Lady Beetle Atlas Coordinator. One is doing a lot of outreach to naturalists across the state in collaboration with other organizations and also just through VCE's Vermont Center for Eco Studies platforms. I do webinars educating people on how to search for, identify, and document lady beetles. I lead a bunch of different lady beetle walks to get people out looking for them, and also spend a lot of time on my own just kind of marching through different parts of Vermont, sweep netting, which is when you have a big insect net and you kind of whack vegetation with it as you walk so you can scoop beetles and other insects into your net and photograph them when they are on their way rapidly out of your net.
Now, Julia, going on a bird walk, you know, you can walk along and actually see birds in trees or flying, but a lady beetle walk, tell us about what it's like, because they're wee. They're just little small things, and they're not going to be flying all over the place. Where do you take people? What goes on during one of those walks?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a lot of times I like taking people to search for lady beetles in edge habitat because that's where I typically have the most luck finding them. So an edge habitat is kind of the boundary where one ecosystem type, say a forest, bleeds into another ecosystem type. For example, a meadow. So in that specific example, you'd have a lot of shrubs, young trees that are growing up, and herbaceous species. So I'll typically find a place that has some nice walking paths, kind of mowed through or around an area like that, and then we'll bring some extra nets so people can learn how to sweep net to search for beetles. But also with some of the larger beetles, such as the polished lady beetle, which is a native species, you can actually see them on vegetation as you're walking. So I'll kind of point out different plants that are good for finding lady beetles, such as milkweed or willows. Joe pieweed can also be good. So then as people are walking, they can kind of start tuning their eyes to small, either orange or black spots that they see on the vegetation, and then you can, just from that visual search, kind of scoop the beetles off to photograph them.
I should mention, we learned last time we had Julia on, ladybugs, lady beetles, same thing. They are indeed beetles. Are there many different types of lady beetles in Vermont?
Definitely. We have at least 45 species. Last year, one of my colleagues, Nathaniel Sharp, found a new native species to the state of Vermont. And when I say new species to the state of Vermont, the species are known to science and known to people in general, but had not been previously documented in the state. And then this year I discovered another two species, both of which are native as well, to the state of Vermont. So I think we probably have more than 45 species. But from what we've found so far, there's at least 45, and 38 of those are native, 7 are introduced. And I should also say that over the past roughly decade, several community naturalists have also reported new lady beetle species for the state to iNaturalist.
Wow. So why are you so excited about lady beetles? What's your interest, Julia?
Well, I think that they are really incredible little critters that have absolutely fascinating life histories. Some of them are migratory. There's one called the five-spotted lady beetle that overwinters, don't ask me why, but it overwinters in high elevation sites under rocks and then migrates down the mountainside to meadows and edge habitats where it feeds and reproduces during the summer. Some lay their eggs in ant nests where their larvae mature, feeding on aphids and honeydew from the aphids that the ants are farming. And they also just play really important roles ecologically. So most, not all, but most lady beetle species feed on small, soft-bodied insects like aphids and scale insects. And those are both tiny insects, or groups of insects, I should say. There's a bunch of different species that feed directly on plants, primarily by, sucking sap out of the plant. But if populations of those small insects get too out of hand, they can really severely damage or kill plants, both in our native ecosystems and in agricultural lands. And lady beetles come in and do an incredible job ensuring that those populations remain in balance. For example, there's one native species found in Vermont called Hyperaspis binotata. It doesn't have a common name, but it's a small black beetle about 4 millimeters in length, one red spot on either wing cover. You can usually find them on top of camel's hump, actually, pretty easily for listeners who are hikers. And before they grow, before they've left their larval stage, pupated and emerged as a beetle, they can eat an estimated 3,000 aphids, and that's just one lady beetle individual.
Wow, you go.
So they are good at their jobs.
I love it. What's the name of the lady beetle that overwinters, the hardy one that overwinters in cold climes up on those mountains?
Yeah, so that is the five-spotted lady beetle. The last one in Vermont was seen in 1890. Hasn't been documented since, so it is unlikely that it is still found here. But it is still found in the United States, especially over in, like, the western half of the U.S.
Now, you mentioned there are 45 different species plus, 45 plus in Vermont, but that there are some that haven't been seen, the long-lost lady beetles. How many of those are there, and what are you trying to do as far as those long-lost, those rare lady beetles?
Yeah, for sure. So I should start by saying that many native lady beetles have been in decline, and that is thought to be caused primarily by the introduction of non-native or invasive species like the Asian lady beetle that people usually find in their houses and land use change. So that can mean, you know, say you have an agricultural field that becomes developed and a mall is built there or something like that. And in Vermont, in 2019, the Vermont Atlas of Life team received a old document from 1976 that was a checklist of lady beetles that had been found up through 1976. And we realized that 13 species on that list had not been documented since either the completion of the list or the late 1990s. So we were like, uh-oh, given the fact that they're declining, many native species are declining across their range, maybe these missing species are extirpated or locally extinct in Vermont. And we wanted to learn more because there hadn't been a good survey done since 1976, really. In 2019, when the Atlas started, there were 13 species that were missing. Now, in 2022, there are 8 species that are missing.
Nice.
We found those five species thus far, hopefully more to come. And the reason why we want to search for them is we want to understand which species are still here, maybe existing in low numbers, like one of the species, the two-spotted lady beetle that I rediscovered, and which ones seem to be totally gone, so we can understand what we can best do to support these native populations. That may be lady beetle reintroductions. That may be looking at different policy options, like listing some of these species as of greatest conservation need or something like that. or kind of looking at non-native lady beetle species and thinking about potential management strategies.
Hmm. Julia, how did you go about searching for the missing lady beetles?
Yeah, so I should start by saying, for anyone interested in more information, if you Google the Vermont Lady Beetle Atlas, it should be one of the first results that pops up, and you can find a ton of information and links so you can directly participate if you like through our Atlas webpage. But we had a couple different strategies to kind of go out and look for these missing species. Last year, we were focused on kind of systematically surveying these roughly 3 by 3 mile grid blocks across the state of Vermont. But that strategy didn't seem to be particularly effective. So this year, we focused on 4 of our missing native lady beetle species, the 2-spotted, 9-spotted, transverse, and 13-spotted lady beetles, which were selected because they used to be some of the most common native species, both in Vermont and across their range, are very important both for natural ecosystems and for agricultural crops, and had been very well surveyed in Vermont in the 1900s. So what we started doing was we mapped out where these lady beetles were historically found, looking on the township level, and then I, along with other community naturalists, have been focusing survey efforts in natural areas that fall within the townships where those beetles were historically documented. And that is actually how I rediscovered 2 missing species earlier this year.
Yeah.
Surveying in one of those historic locations.
All right. Here's where we get to the good part, unfortunately, that our interview got cut off last time. So you're out there looking for these missing lady beetles. And what happened the first time?
Yeah. So to sort of paint a picture for you all, I typically will veer off of the trail that I'm on a little bit. It was pretty early in the morning, probably around 9 a.m. I was one of the only people out in the Mills Riverside Natural Area. And I was just kind of sweep netting along the edge, focusing on some willows and the surrounding herbaceous species, because those are species and kind of ecosystem types where I usually have good luck looking for lady beetles. I was kind of just, you know, waving my net around, walking and half-tripping through all this vegetation. When I open my net up, I see this little red lady beetle in there and think, oh, cool, a streaked lady beetle. That's a species that's not super common, but also not uncommon. I've only found one before, so I was pretty excited. And then I scoop this lady beetle into a vial and take a closer look and go, oh, that's a 2-spotted lady beetle. I immediately just, I don't even know, I felt my stomach like drop to my feet. I was super excited, but I thought, all right, wait, you probably have more beetles in your net, so take another look before you start photographing this guy and messaging my supervisor and everything.
Right.
And so I opened the net back up, and lo and behold, there is a second 2-spotted lady beetle in my net at the same time.
Oh.
And at that point, I was like, all right. So I get both of them out, start photographing, run into this random person who was walking, asked me what I was doing, and I was like, look, these haven't been seen since 1996. I think they thought that was pretty interesting, but they were also like, what is this person doing? But yeah, that's how it happened.
Wow. And so how big are these nets that you're using, you're sweep netting with?
Yeah, so the handle is about 40-ish inches long, and then
wow.
The diameter of the net is about 18 inches. So they're, you know, they're pretty big.
Yeah.
The net is also pretty long. So you can really, you can kind of like get some good vegetation wax in there. but yeah, they can definitely be a little unwieldy in the tighter vegetation areas.
Mm. And what can you tell us about this 2-spotted lady beetle?
For sure. So this species to kind of give you a visual image of what it looks like. It is a very round beetle. Overall, it's typically about 3.5 to 5.2 millimeters in length. So, you know, maybe about half the diameter of a dime to kind of give a reference there. It has a black head that has two little white spots above or right next to its eyes. The middle section, which is called the pronotum, is kind of half white and half black. The sides are white, and then it has almost an M shape in black in the center. And then its wings, or elytra, the wing covers, I should say, or elytra, are typically a reddish-orange color with two black spots, one on each wing cover, but they sometimes have four smaller black spots in a straight line across the middle of those wing covers, or they can be jet black with red spots. So they can really vary in appearance, but, you know, it's important to look at each part of the beetle, look at the legs, photograph everything, and then from there really determine whether it is the beetle you think it is or not.
Right.
But this species is really important for pest management in agricultural areas and in natural ecosystems. It does really like arboreal or forested ecosystems, but is more of a generalist, so you can, that's why you can find it in crops or meadows, like where I found it, or in trees. And like I was saying, it was once one of the most common native species across its range, which was much of North America, but has really sharply declined since sort of the mid-1990s. More towards the late 1990s, I'd say 70s, 80s are when people really started noticing those declines. And it's thought to be primarily caused by non-native species like the Asian lady beetle and 14 spotted, but also that land use change component as well.
Now, Julia, that's you found that. That's one off the list. And you had kind of a short list you were looking for, but you found another rare or extinct lady beetle in Vermont, and that wasn't on your short list. What was that one, and how did you find it?
Yep. So about 50 feet from where I'd found the two spotted lady beetles, I was there photographing them until my phone died, and I went, oh, okay. I'll just keep surveying, and if I find anyone else in the next hour, I'll collect them and bring them back to my car so I can charge my phone and photograph them before releasing them. But when I was about 50 feet away from where I found the two spotted lady beetles, I opened my net up again. First, didn't think there were any beetles in there, and then I see this little black speck running around, and I was like, oh, there's one. So I scoop it into a vial and look at it, and it was none other than the esteemed sigil lady beetle. So these little ones are only 2 to 3 millimeters in length. They have either a black or pale head that differentiates. Black head is female versus male head is pale. A black pronotum, again, that's the middle section with two white patches on either side towards the front. That's called the anterolateral angle, for a nice sciencey term there. Mm-hmm. And then their wing covers are jet black except for two orange spots, one on each wing cover in the middle, and then four pale small spots along the back, two on each wing cover.
Wow.
Yeah.
And has that been confirmed? I know originally that needed to be, identified properly to make sure that that was indeed the esteemed beetle.
Yes, it has been confirmed by several naturalists, which is super exciting. And, you know, this one hadn't been documented in Vermont since 1972. Mm. There's really not much known about it. After doing a literature review for each of the species to kind of, you know, gather as much data as I could, I have a single sentence for habitat, food, and life cycle being it likely lives in woodlands, orchards, and sometimes fields. It eats scale insects and seems to be most abundant between July and August. And then the real kicker, little is known about this insect.
Wow.
So it's pretty cool that there, you know, we have another, this is only the second record in the state of Vermont, and now we know that they can be found in kind of those edge habitats, or at least this one did.
And how long, so we have about 30 seconds left, how long can the hunt for lady beetles go on to keep trying to, during the course of the year, to keep trying to find these rare ones?
Yeah, so lady beetles really start hibernating for the winter, entering diapause between September and October, whenever it starts getting cold. So that will be through the end of this year, but keep searching for them and keep uploading things to iNaturalist even after this season when the Lady Beetle Atlas is kind of concluded, because, you know, finding a rare beetle or finding any beetle, whether there's an active atlas or not, is important and worth documenting.
Really exciting stuff. Julia Pupko is the Community Science Outreach Naturalist with the Vermont Center for Eco Studies. She's the Vermont Lady Beetle Atlas Coordinator. You can learn more about her work with lady beetles. You can visit val.vtecostudies.org or, as Julia said, Google VT Lady Beetle Atlas. Julia, thank you so much for the work you're doing and for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Really,
I feel bad that during these two conversations, you could have found two more species. Take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we'll hear from Lola DeFore of VT Digger about a few statewide races in Vermont ahead of next Tuesday's primary. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. We've spent about a month and a half hearing from candidates who are in statewide races in next Tuesday's primaries. And if you haven't thought about it, yes, the primaries are next Tuesday. And you can go to the polls then, or if you're going to be out of town or, you know, something will distract you, you can go to your town hall. You can go to your town clerk's office and vote now. It's probably too late to send in an absentee ballot if you were going to do that. So if you have one and you want to vote, you can, you'd probably want to take it directly to the town clerk's office at this point. When did I go? Last Thursday or Friday, I had a few minutes and dashed over to my town clerk's office to vote. I like to do that to make sure that nothing happens on election day to me. And so I, you know, if I have the opportunity, will vote early. We hope to have Lola DeFore of VT Digger, the political reporter, on with us, but right now we're having problems connecting, and we want to talk specifically about the congressional race, which is very interesting, but we might get a little bit too on the Senate race, and I think we might have Lola on now. So during the time, you know, campaigns have reported how much money they've brought in, candidates have dropped out of the race. We even had polling data, which is something we don't always have much of for Vermont political races, especially our primaries. But it all tells a pretty compelling story in this year of having many more than usual open seats for statewide offices. Now we have Lola DeFore joining us. She is the political reporter for VT Digger. Hi, Lola.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. Listeners, if you have questions about the races, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Lola, let's look at this congressional race and who entered the primary race to begin with. Who were the three Republicans who are on the ballot?
Are you talking the house race, right?
House race.
So we have Liam Madden, who's actually an independent, who has said that he got on the Republican ballot because of, you know, he doesn't like the two-party system, and he thinks this is just the best way to get his name out. You have Anya Tinio, who is from the Northeast Kingdom, and then you have Erica Reddick, who is a Burlington accountant.
And Anya Tinio is making her third attempt for the congressional seat. What do we know about her two previous runs?
Well, she was the nominee once, but yes, she's certainly never succeeded in the general election. And I mean, it's That's about it.
Okay.
That's about all I know about her previous run.
Yeah, I believe last time she lost, in 2018, she lost pretty badly to Brooke Page, who is on the ballot a number of times this year. And then he stepped aside and had her run. But she is in this three-way race on the Republican side, as you mentioned, with Erica Reddick and Liam Madden, who is an independent. The Dems started off with a field of five. Tell us about that lineup.
Yeah, that has been a very interesting field. So we had Molly Gray, Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray, who was first out of the gate. And then we had Senate President Pro Tempore Becca Ballant. And then we had Keisha Ram Hinsdale, who was a state senator from Chittenden County. And we also had Lewis Myers, who is a physician over in South Burlington, who's also, I think, run for state senate in the past unsuccessfully. And then we had Sinead Chase Clifford, who's from Essex. She had been an aide in Representative Ayanna Pressley's office in Massachusetts. And so that was our field a few months ago, but it's since significantly winnowed.
It has slimmed down a bit.
It has.
So back in April, Lola, the UNH poll had Becca Ballant with 28%, Molly Gray with 21%, and Ram Hinsdale with 19%, yet Keisha drops out just a month later. So what happened there?
Well, you know, the narrative that we heard from the Becca Ballant and Keisha Ram Hinsdale campaigns was that they really wanted to unify the left. And, you know, there was a little bit of an anybody but Molly Gray narrative there. And so Keisha Ram Hinsdale must have felt that she, you know, had the least likely path out of the three. It also seems like her campaign had basically run out of cash. And so it was going to be very, very hard to compete. So she dropped out and she backed Ballant, who had been, you know, really starting to pick up momentum. And it seems, you know, has really kind of leapt to the front of the pack, at least if you believe the latest polling. But there are, I'd say, other indicators, which are not hard data, but other indicators that suggest that she is indeed picking up enormous momentum. There was also, I mean, Bernie Sanders has come out and endorsed her, and just this weekend on Sunday, barnstormed with her at three events in Rutland, Montpelier, and then Burlington.
Sinead Chase Clifford, a social worker and really a political newcomer as far as running, dropped out more recently. Why did she say she abandoned her run?
She said she abandoned her run because, you know, she was very forthright. She was like, I don't have the money to compete, which is difficult because I never made fundraising a priority, and I wanted to run a campaign and say that you don't need to run to raise, you know, $1 million
right
to run for office and be taken seriously. I'm kind of paraphrasing, but one of her quotes to us was really like that, you know, it's sick that you actually need $1 million to get that message out. And so she dropped out. She did not endorse either Becca Ballant or Molly Gray or Lewis Myers, who's still in the race and running a largely self-funded campaign. He's, I think, loaned himself somewhere on the order of $250,000. So, right, the field is now down to three.
And, you know, as sad as it is, money does make a difference in keeping a campaign afloat, you know, and it's just difficult to run a campaign without a few hundred thousand dollars statewide, and, you know, the time it takes to do so, the staff you'd need to do so, and then, of course, those yard signs. But let's look at the numbers. This UNH poll was updated just recently. Like I said, first it was back in April. The numbers much different this time. And what it said, and again, we take all these polls with a grain of salt, but even still, these numbers were rather robust for Becca Ballant.
Yeah, I mean, I was, along with, I think, quite a few observers, I was just astounded, like, frankly incredulous when I saw the UNH poll that came out in the congressional race that showed Becca Ballant 42 points ahead of Molly Gray. I think the assumption everywhere had been that this would be a relatively close race. You know, plenty of people have been telling me for about a month that, you know, Becca Ballant is really picking up momentum. Molly Gray isn't. Molly Gray's campaign was also going pretty negative against Becca Ballant, mm-hmm. which, you know, is usually an indication that a campaign is under some amount of stress and worried about where the, you know, the numbers are headed. But I was still pretty startled. And I think, I mean, I don't know how much people outside of, you know, people who are obsessed with politics and political reporters will care about this, but I'll be very curious when this all shakes out to kind of compare where the race has landed and, you know, where these polls predicted that they would. It's also notable that this poll out of UNH is, you know, using a pretty new methodology. So this will be kind of a test of that. But of course, something that I've heard from a lot of people and thought myself is even if they're off by 20 points, that gives the race to Becca Ballant by 20 points, right? So
here's what the poll found. So these would be likely Democratic voters. Ballant had 63%, Gray 21%, one third of how Ballant polled. Myers had 2%. And this is the other thing I found very interesting. Only 13% undecided. And that, you know, that it has to worry Molly Gray as well, because there isn't that huge undecided vote that she might tap into.
Yes, yes. And this is something that was very different from the other campaigns that were polled by UNH, where, you know, by and large, the winning candidate in a lot of these races was undecided.
Right.
And, you know, where you had certainly candidates that were out ahead, but you know, just such a huge number of people that hadn't made up their minds where it could really go either way. And that was the case in the lieutenant governor's race on both the Republican and Democratic side. I mean, there were fewer undecideds in the Democratic primary. Like half of all, I think, Republican Party voters that were polled in the Republican LG race were undecided. So, I mean, that race is completely up in the air if you look at that poll, even though Joe Benning is up. So, no, I mean, it's definitely a very, very bad poll for the Molly Gray campaign, although, you know, I should stress that, like, there are very few states in which, like, people will hyper-focus on one poll. Like, there's just been so little public polling in this race that we're spending a lot of time looking at this one. But it's, you know, usually best practice to have a bunch of polling that you can look at.
And alas, normally for Vermont primaries, we're lucky if we get any polling. So, Lola, we talked about the polling on the Democratic side. Now looking at the Republican side. You know, the numbers here, it's hard to kind of get your mind around, if they mean anything at all. The UNH poll found that, Erica Reddick was polling at 15%, Leah Madden 14%, Anya Tino at just 9%, and undecided a whopping 58%. So what's your take on those numbers?
I mean, my take on those numbers is, and this is, they're fairly meaningless.
Yeah.
I mean, they're within the margin of error. And so I think the only interesting thing, or I think the only thing about those numbers, the only thing those numbers tell us is that not a lot of people are paying any attention to the Republican House primary.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, probably because the assumption is from most folks that the primary is the election, right? And that that Vermont is going to send a Democrat to Washington in that race. I mean, I know that that's been the assumption, that the Democrats are basically running their campaigns accord. You know, like they're spending all their cash now before primary day. And that's because I think they don't really expect to have to fight that hard in the general election.
Speaking of cash, Lola, you mentioned it earlier, but how are the candidates doing with raising money? What are the numbers for Ballant, for Gray, and for anybody who will be challenging them on the Republican side?
I can't recall what the numbers are on the Republican side. I mean, there were very little.
Yeah.
Ballant and Gray are both – have both raised roughly $1 million each. And then what's also a huge number is that there are a few national PACs. There's the House Progressive Congressional Progressive Caucus PAC, and also two very important LGBTQ PACs that are that's a political action committee that are backing Ballant, and together they've spent about $1 million, I think close to $1 million, just in July, and so the equivalent of like one other campaign has basically backed Ballant in the money race, and I'm sure people are getting inundated with mailers for Rebecca Ballant right now. I certainly have.
And we should mention that PACs cannot coordinate with a campaign, and they can spend limitless amounts, correct, to support an issue or a candidate.
Yes, that's the these are like hybrid PACs, but they can basically act sort of like super PACs. So if they don't coordinate with the campaign, they can spend unlimited amounts of money, and they are, you know, spending very large on the Becca Ballant campaign, which is something that Molly Gray has tried to go after her about. And, you know, this has been a really interesting kind of surprise for me and I think a lot of other observers, because I think the assumption would be that Molly Gray, who was a fantastic fundraiser in her LG run, would win the money race. And that would be a real strength of her campaign. And at the end of the day, you know, Becca Ballant has been able to compete and then get all this outside help. Money is not determinative in a political race, but here it is. It has become such an obvious advantage for Becca Ballant, which was, not, I think, what a lot of people were expecting.
Yeah, not at all. I do want to mention that we do have three major parties in Vermont, and the Progressives do have a candidate running unopposed in their primary. Do you know anything about Barbara Nolfi?
No, I mean, I believe she's just kind of a placeholder on the candidate on the ballot. You know, so that before you'd have a. The Progressive Party would often have their ballot kind of, you know, hijacked by other kind of random candidates. You'd often have like Chris Erickson on the Progressive ballot. So they kind of put placeholders, but their candidate had been actually Sinead Chase Clifford. She had gotten the Progressive Party endorsement in the Democratic primary. So she was running in the Democratic primary. She's now dropped out. And she had been officially backed by the Progressive Party.
Interesting. All right. I will tell you what I learned about Barbara Nolfi, just because I find it interesting. She's 80 years old, attended Cal Berkeley, founded the Earthworks Commune in Fairfield back in the 60s or 70s, and was a midwife. So if you pick the progressive ballot and you vote for Barbara Nolfi, you now have a little background on who you're voting for. We've got about 30 seconds left. I thought it was quite interesting in the Senate primary for GOP, the numbers there, which had Malloy with 30%, Christina Nolan with just 24%. Now, granted, a high undecided, but surprised by those numbers?
I was very surprised by those numbers. Sorry, I'm telling my editor.
Okay.
I can't talk right now. No, those were very surprising numbers. I mean, Christina Nolan has received the backing, obviously, of Governor Phil Scott, who's extraordinarily popular in Vermont, along with, you know, basically the entire national Republican apparatus has decided to back her. She's done fundraisers with Mitch McConnell and Susan Collins, I think the RNC committee man, for the Vermont GOP was, was highly involved in her campaign. So she was quite obviously the Republican Party pick in so many ways. And she also had already quite a public profile, having been the U.S. attorney for Vermont. She was a Trump appointee, but she was nominated with bipartisan recommendations from Leahy and
Lola, we're going to have to leave it there, but I agree with you as well. Shocking numbers for both Molly Gray and Christina Nolan. Lola DeFore is the political reporter for VT Digger. Stay up to date on the election at vtdigger.org. Lola, thanks so much for being on this morning.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.